Hi, this is John Neff, Global Editor-in-Chief of MotorOne.com, and welcome to a new edition of the MotorOne.com podcast. Today, I'll be discussing the debuts of the New York Auto Show with my co-host. The first is MotorOne.com senior editor, Jeff Perez. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good, thanks. And occupying the third chair of our roundtable this week is writer Cam Vanderhorst. How you doing, Cam?
I'm doing great.
As I said, I want to talk about the New York Auto Show debuts. We're recording this podcast on Tuesday, and it's the day before the first press day of the New York Auto Show, which is Wednesday. But since we are automotive journalists, we get access to see what is going to debut a little early. So we pretty much know everything that's going to be there. And I want to hear from you guys what you're most excited about, what cars and concepts are debuting at the show that you think are the coolest, most interesting, most impactful. So let's start with you, Cam. What are you excited about from the New York Auto Show?
Well, when you say most impactful, I don't think any of my choices would necessarily be considered impactful. Well, we'll start out with the one that might be, the Lincoln Corsair. I don't get excited about crossovers pretty much at all. Lincoln has been making really good cars for years, and Lincoln's problem has been, since it kind of reinvented itself, so we'll call it the alphanumeric era, right?
Right.
Since Lincoln has kind of reinvented themselves, they've made great cars that have all competed in segments filled with tremendous cars.
Yep, I'd agree with that.
So it's been really, really hard to, it's the kind of thing where so when somebody asks you about a car, a non-car friend asks you about a car, they're looking for validation, right? They want you to tell them that what they're about to buy or what they've probably already bought is a good car. Somebody comes up to you and says, I bought a Lincoln XYZ. You're genuinely happy for them. It's a great car.
I would agree. I would do the same.
They probably didn't want an Audi. They probably didn't want an equivalent BMW. They got what they wanted. Lincoln has kind of, I think, figured out the recipe for what an American luxury brand should be in a way that Cadillac has come so close to and not quite nailed. So like the Continental is fantastic. That car has a presence to it.
Yes.
I feel, looking at a new Continental, I feel the same way that my parents, when they were my age, probably felt when they looked at a Continental in the 60s, right? Which is great. They've got this weird retro futuristic jet age styling going for them. They've got a lot going for them. I really like them. They've got proven Ford drivetrains.
The Corsair is basically the replacement for the MKC, which was the Lincoln compact luxury crossover.
Right.
So the MKC, that was the alphanumeric name. So this is basically a full redesign for the MKC along with a renaming to Corsair. I agree with you 100%. I think Lincoln has not only beaten Cadillac to shifting most of its attention to crossovers away from its sedans, because, you know, whether you think that's unfortunate or not is everyone's, you know, personal opinion, but the market is telling these companies, go to crossovers, go to SUVs. That's where you will find the money to survive, and then those will pay for your good cars. I think Cadillac didn't get the memo early enough, and they made great cars at a time when nobody's buying cars. But man, if you look at, and people will see this when they see the Corsair launch, I particularly like Lincoln's interiors lately. They're having fun. They're being bold.
I'm saying this retro future. It's like what we thought 2018 was going to look like during the height of the jet age, or 2019 was going to look like during the height of the jet age. And it's great. I'm so glad people are doing that.
Yeah. And oh man, the Lincoln seats are industry best. I love their kind of floating seats. I tried some in the Continental and absolutely loved them. All right. So what are a couple others that you're looking forward to?
I'm actually looking forward to the Nissan anniversary models.
Really?
Yeah. Nissan's kind of a dirty word amongst a lot of the automotive press. And the problem there's two problems with the automotive press versus regular people that buy cars, right?
At least two problems.
At least two problems, right. And one of them is that we only have to live with, you know, we only have to put up with something for like 2 or 3 weeks at a time.
While we're reviewing it.
So we see the car on its absolute best behavior.
Mm-hmm. And usually a fully loaded model.
Best
foot forward.
The other thing is that we have to judge cars based on MSRP, which kills Nissan all the time. Look at a base Z. A base Z starts at, does a base Z still start around $29,000? A base model Z, you can actually go to a dealer and buy one for closer to like $23,000, $24,000.
We review a lot of cars where, yeah, we judge them on MSRP, but any real person who went to the dealer would get thousands of dollars of cash on the hood to take.
Yeah. And that puts it, you know, right up there with an FRS, or I guess, I'm sorry, the GT86 now, or the BRZ.
What are they debuting in New York though? Of the
So they're doing a heritage paint scheme that looks like the BRE Datsun paint scheme with, you know, with the two backslash kind of shaped graphics on the side. For the GTR, they're doing a retro paint scheme that looks like the cars that were racing in the 71 GTRs that were racing at the time. I wish they would have done, instead of doing a metallic blue with a white stripe, they would have gone closer to the original and done a cream white with a blue stripe.
I'm the same way. I'm a sucker for, you know, special editions that are just the heritage throwbacks, even when they're light stuff, like just a paint job.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't buy one myself, but I'm the kind of person who I'm just happy they exist.
They almost always are paint and graphic specials. And that's just kind of an accepted part of it. A few years ago, Subaru did, I think maybe last year, they did like a heritage edition that actually had some of the performance goodies as standard bundled into the package with it. But the color they picked was this, it wasn't an unattractive color, but it's a color I wouldn't have wanted on a BRZ or a WRX. Jeff, I think you know what I'm talking about, right?
I think so, yeah.
That kind of steel blue color. It looked like something your dad would drive. And if you're buying a WRX. That's not...
It's not like the classic Subaru blue. It's more like a lighter kind of blue.
Yeah, they were trying to like reinvent it, and it didn't work out.
No, I wasn't in love with that.
How about one more vehicle from you, Cam?
All right, so I'm excited about the new the cheapo boost. What did I call it? The new I called it the cheapo boost. It's a performance package. I was recently in the market
Ford Mustang, right?
Yeah. I was recently in the market for a new car. I was looking around the $30,000 range. At something that would be a practical everyday car, but also a fun car. And I ended up canceling my order on a new WRX and buying a 28-year-old pickup truck instead. For automotive journalist reasons, that's the kind of thing, those are the kind of decisions we do, which is why you shouldn't take our advice on anything. But it's got the Focus RS engine in it. There's going to be an additional handling package available, but by any accounts, that's going to be another car that's competing in that, you know, right around $30,000 price range.
Yeah, so the entire Motor One writing team, editors and writers, we've gotten into large debates over our chat rooms about this Mustang. What is the official name of it? Mustang 2.3?
It's a very dull, boring name.
It's like High Performance 2.3 or something ridiculous.
But yeah, it's the EcoBoost High Performance Package, which replaces the EcoBoost Performance Package.
It's using either the same or a very similar version of the 2.3-liter turbocharged four-cylinder that the Ford Focus RS used. And of course, we don't have that car anymore. So it seems like Ford has basically taken that engine out of the now extinct Ford Focus RS and put it in the Mustang. It only ends up with, I think, something like 30 extra horsepower over the base EcoBoost Mustang. But Ford says the torque curve is a lot wider. And they actually quoted 0 to 60 time of mid 4 seconds, which is crazy to me that we're talking about like base model performance cars in the mid 4 second range.
That's properly quick. That's yeah.
It is absolutely. I mean, look, I'm not a young man anymore. I'm not super old, but when I was a kid and you know, reading car magazines back in the day in the 90s, and the Viper came out and it had 400 horsepower and did 0 to 60 in 4 point something. That to me was the fastest thing I'd ever heard of. And now we're talking about a, you know, $31,000 Mustang that can do mid fours with a 4-cylinder. So I think it's unfortunate that and I'm sucking up all the good comments about it. You guys, I don't know, maybe you guys will disagree. I think the only unfortunate thing about it is the name. I think they passed up on a great marketing opportunity. Right. And then I think the look, like the grill and the special 2.3-liter badge, it's not very exciting. The look of it, the aesthetics of it don't get me very excited.
It's very, maybe they're going for some kind of a sleeper look to it or something. I don't know. I'm not going to make excuses for Ford. I just got a box in the mail today that a few years ago would have been Ford Racing Performance Parts, which was super cool when you got a box that said Ford Racing on it, made you feel like some kind of sponsored driver. All of their performance parts now were under that Ford Performance brand. So when they killed off SVT, which as a 90s kid, that hurt. You know, that affected me. That really hurt. The part I got were coil covers for my car that said powered by SVT on them from the older GT500s. But they're in a Ford Performance box, and it's like the Ford Performance branding just seems kind of neutered compared to Ford Racing.
It just feels like their branding is kind of all over the place, right? They have an Edge ST, but they can't slap an RS or an ST badge on the Mustang, right? It just feels weird.
They're very lucky that they have the following they do and the product that they do, because the branding would have... Like, think about how branding has killed some of the luxury car manufacturers. Like, going back to Lincoln, they just now realized the alphanumeric thing does not work for American manufacturers.
I think a lot of people were also disappointed that a turbocharged Mustang, especially one with a performance edge, wasn't called an SVO with a callback to those Mustangs in the 80s.
Yeah, that was a huge missed opportunity there.
I don't know why Ford does that, and I don't know why they're taking some of these cool packages that they're offering for the Mustang and giving them these weird long names rather than, I mean, even just look at Camaro, like the name 1LE doesn't necessarily, it's not like a, you know, a performance brand that we remember, but at least it's easy to say, right? At least it's,
yeah, well, it has its own sort of like strength in branding to it, right? I mean, the 1LE, like you said, 1LE is not like a huge name, but you can at least look at that and be like, oh, Camaro Turbo 1LE, like that's cool, you know?
Well, the 1LE name actually goes back to the handling package for the third gen IROC Camaros. That was like kind of a secret thing. It was like an SCCA showroom stock package. Like all of GM's, it's cool that they use the codes from the option list as the name of the car. That's like a really cool historical thing. And what's great is that also means that you can come up with new option codes and it'll still have that heritage going back half a century.
All right. None of this matters because Ford will still sell 10 times more of those Mustangs than Chevy will those Camaros. So such
is the way of the world and it will always be that way. Jeff, what are you excited about from the New York show?
I have kind of a weird one that I'm excited about. The new Mercedes-Benz GLS.
Oh, that is an interesting choice.
7-seat, 3-row, updated GLS. Well, brand new. It's not updated. Finally gets the twin-turbo V8 with EQ boost. It also gets the base inline-6. That's a great engine. And it's got 483 horsepower, which is kind of ridiculous. I think the BMW...
Is that engine, though? That's not even... Obviously, that's not an AMG tune or an AMG trim. That's just the top engine available is 480 horsepower?
Yeah, 483 horsepower. And the base inline six is 362, which both...
Not bad either.
Yeah. How much torque on that base inline six? It's okay if you don't have it in front of you.
369. And both of those are more than the X7 by like a good margin.
Yeah, it sounds like it. We're going to angle for that comparison test as hard as we can to get a good comparison out for people because, man, GLS versus BMW X7. I imagine most buyers have already picked the brand they're going to buy from because it's like you know if you're going to be an F-150 or a Silverado person. I imagine BMW and Mercedes people are the same way. The three-row SUV war has picked up, and these two guys have the biggest guns. So
yeah,
a good choice.
I'm excited for that too, just based on the fact I drove the X7 and when you get all the M Sport stuff on it, it drives really well. I mean, for a three-row SUV, it's surprisingly good. Assuming that Mercedes will do the same AMG line stuff with that one, and I'm assuming they're going to have a 63 version, that thing has got to be crazy to drive.
I like the Benz too because it doesn't have that stupid dead fish roof line every Mercedes sedan has.
Yeah.
It's the only thing that can make me like SUVs is that if it's a Benz SUV that has a normal roof line.
All right, how about another one, Jeff?
You know, I like the new Outback even though it's kind of a subtle update. I think it's cool.
Yeah, the Subaru, like I said, this is the day before the show and we've only got like one or two pictures of the Outback to go on. Yeah, I like it. I like that the one they're introducing, at least the one that we have pictures of, have the matte black. I don't know if it's cladding or if it's just those body panels are in matte black, but I've always loved when Subaru gives you that kind of down and dirty trim level. You know, you can get the body panel scratched instead of like the, you know, the limited trim where they're all painted body color. And
yeah, I mean, it's hard visually, like when you look at the new one compared to the previous gen, they look, I mean, almost identical. Some of the new, there's new body cladding up front. There's some extra stuff over the fenders, which just, I mean, they really don't need to do that much to make that car more appealing to that audience.
Yeah. I don't know how it could be more appealing. I mean, they sell right. every single one they
yeah.
make.
Yeah.
The Forester, I was surprised with how, when the new Forester came out this year, I was surprised with how different it was than the outgoing Forester. Because Subaru is so very conservative with everything they do, right?
They are. And the Forester is a weird one because it has changed shape, I think, over the years more than any other Subaru product as they've tried to figure out what exactly it is. And I think they have, you know, come to decide this is a compact crossover. This is what we need to sell it as. That's the hottest segment. So it's kind of morphed into that shape over the generations. All right, so I've got a few. I think mine are a little odd as well. I'll see what you guys think. So my first one is probably going to be one that wouldn't show up on anyone's list. It's the Volkswagen Atlas Base Camp. And this is I'm pretty sure it's a concept. I don't know if they'll release it as a trim, but I chose it because it supports my assertion that I always say, which is that taking a crossover and making a butch version of it always makes it look better. And everybody always hates these versions of crossovers because they're faux SUVs. They can't do anything off-road better.
They're sheep and wool. They're sheep and wool.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. No one is mistaking any of these crossovers that have, you know, knobbier tires and bigger fender flares and you know, faux brush guards. They're not confusing them with Jeeps or anything. But in my opinion, every crossover looks better when it's butched up. And that's what they've done with the Basecamp. And I also give Volkswagen 10 bonus points for having it pull a teardrop trailer because I'm also obsessed with motorhomes, RVs, and trailers. I love that they did that.
That's hot. That's really, really hot. I'm not even ashamed of the fact I like this thing.
I like the Atlas just in general. I mean, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't inspire a lot of passion in me, but when you look at the mainstream high volume three row crossover segment, it's a really good choice. It's totally solid. It's one of those vehicles where, again, like you said, Cam, if somebody came up to me and said, I bought a Volkswagen Atlas, I'd be like, yeah, good choice. That's totally choice. Decent. Yeah.
What Volkswagen did here was they built a Subaru Ascent.
You're not wrong. I think that's going to be the next big thing though, John, like you said, is butched up crossovers.
Yeah. Look, everybody's got to find what they're going to name it. Like this one's the Basecamp.
Everybody's got great names for them.
For Nissan, what is it? The Rocky Ridge or something? Or the Rock Ridge, I think.
Something
I
don't like know. That. Rock Creek or something.
Rock Creek Edition, yeah. So everyone's got a cool like butch name for it. And I like if I were in the auto industry, like on the other side of the fence, I would love to be on those teams that, you know, the boss comes to us and says, we need a butch looking version of our hot selling family crossover. I'm like, I want to be on that team.
Yeah.
I want to go shopping in the SEMA parts bin for all the add-ons that are going to make it look like it.
You spend a lot of time at LL Bean. And then what I would do is I would hire John St. John, the voice actor that did Duke Nukem, to read all of the names that we came up with and then see which ones sounded the best.
See which ones sounded the best. Yeah. No, I think it's great. Whoever listened to this podcast over the long term, you will hear me espouse this assertion every time one comes up.
We had one of your favorites a few weeks ago, John, the Soul X line.
Oh yeah. The Soul X line.
I just think that's so funny. Like, could you imagine that meeting where they realize that more people want rugged, you know, crossovers? They're like, all right, we're going to stick some cladding on this Soul and we're going to put some bigger wheels and lift it by, you know, like a centimeter.
I will bet you my last dollar that they sell more X lines than they do GT Souls.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, because all of the companies seem to be going where they're branching off or they're doing like a street, one that looks like a street performance line, or it might fool you, a passerby into thinking that it's like a luxury SUV. And then that's just what Toyota did in Japan, which Japan's car market is totally wacky compared to ours. But I was really surprised when you told me that article was popping. And then I was less surprised thinking, well, because Toyota just came out with two street performance versions of the RAV4 and two off-road versions of the RAV4. It made sense for them to do that.
let me move on to my second one because I have a third too. The second one is the Hyundai Sonata, the 2020 model, totally redesigned. This one is it's debuting at the auto show, but it has been out in public for at least a month now. We've actually even published our own first drive of the Sonata, but this is the first time we're going to see it in person. And the reason I think the Sonata is so special is because it is gorgeous. It will perhaps be, to me at least, the most attractive sedan on the market, regardless of price. And the reason I think that's so special is because I've always felt that an automaker, no matter what price level it's selling a sedan at or any car, that the design of a car doesn't cost extra. Like, it doesn't cost extra for you to make a car beautiful. Like, you could make the Nissan Sentra beautiful. I feel like you just choose not to, or you make it a little less beautiful so that people buy an Altima. Where the Sonata, I feel, is like, you know, it's going to be a $25,000 family sedan, and it's going to look like a Jaguar. You know, it's almost like when the current generation Ford Fusion came out, and everyone's like, oh my God, that looks like an Aston Martin. I'm like, yeah, that's so smart, because does it really cost you extra to make a beautiful $25,000 car? And I think here, Hyundai, much like it did with the Sonata two generations ago, is going to hit the market and make a lot of waves with having the most beautiful family sedan. And I'll tell you another difference this makes when you do it wrong. When you're Honda and you go out on a limb and make your Accord a little weird looking, the sales can fall through the floor.
Art is very subjective, but there's styling features that are objectively and subjectively beautiful, right? That like pretty much everybody agrees on. And I think Honda decided to be different instead of being beautiful. And that's costing them.
There's a distinction between those two things. And yeah. Honda's learning the hard way what that distinction is.
I kind of have a lukewarm take on the Sonata. I'm not in love with it. It's fine. It's okay. I don't know. Everybody's losing their minds. And it's I love that it's different, right? And to John's point, there's no harm in trying something different and reaching out in that segment, especially when, you know, crossovers are just dominating.
Right. The sedan market needs this.
Yeah, but it's fine. I don't know,
man. Park a Camry next to it and then tell me what you think of it.
Fair.
Here's my concern with the Sonata. And I don't think it's as valid this time around, because Hyundai and Kia have made great strides in the past few years. I used to be the biggest critic of those two brands, and they've really been doing things right lately. But remember when the 2011 Sonata came out? It looked beautiful for about 18 months because they were coming out with a new car when everything else in its class was doing its mid-cycle refresh. It looked really good for a short period of time, and then it looked incredibly dated.
So you're talking about the generation before this last one. And I think that generation looked good throughout its whole life cycle. I think it looked forward facing.
Yeah, it never looked bad, but there was a time pretty shortly after it came out where it went from looking like the hottest thing on the block to looking kind of dated. Everything caught up pretty quick. And I think Hyundai's finally got their timing right.
I'm eager to see our live pictures from that and some video that we're going to do with the Sonata. I do have a third vehicle. And again, it's a little bit of an odd one that I don't think it's not going to make waves to show. It's the Acura TMX PMC edition. Pardon the name, because that's a mouthful. It's a regular old TLX, which is their large, luxury sedan. But it is hand assembled at the same factory in Ohio that assembles the NSX supercar. So this is a hand built TLX, and they're using all of the special skills, the training, and the quality that they put into the NSX build into their a couple of their high volume models. So they're going to do this with the TLX, and they're also going to do this with the MDX, and they're going to be called PMC editions because the name of that factory in Ohio is the Performance Manufacturing Center. And I think this is so interesting that they're doing this, and I love that they're celebrating an assembly plant. I love that they did something really special with the NSX. They built a whole factory for it. Now they're going to try to get their money's worth and do something more with it than just the NSX. And I think this is a really cool way to do it. If I were driving this around, I'd feel so cool that I had this thing that nobody knew about, like that is extra special. Imagine 20 years from now, it's going to be one of those cars that we all talk about that, you know, comes up on Bring a Trailer as, oh my God, I remember those. They only made like 500 of them.
Yeah. I can't believe they actually built that.
Also, it's from Ohio, and I'm talking to you from Cleveland. Cam's talking to you from Akron, and for once, we finally outnumber our colleagues in Miami. Jeff, you're in Miami right now. So Ohio for the win. Ohio manufacturing is back.
Yeah, basically doing the exact opposite of what GM did with Lordstown.
Yeah, exactly.
Make every small sedan there, or every small two-door coupe sedan car, you know, economy car there for
decades,
like half a century, and then close the plant and then immediately file a patent on the name of the one that you used to make there that you're going to make in Mexico.
Well, maybe Honda should buy the Lordstown brand.
That's what we call bad optics.
Can I be cynical though on the TLX?
Yeah.
Because sure. not to offend our friends at Honda Acura, I think it's awesome. I think the TLX hand built is super cool. But when an average consumer walks into a dealership, right, and they see that parked next to another TLX, do you think they'll care? Do you think they'll be like, wow, that's awesome? I think it's a little too inside baseball, right? Like, we think it's awesome, but the average consumer probably doesn't.
Yeah, that's why they'll only sell 500 of them.
And that's all they want to sell. They're not making the, like, I mean, they're hand-built, so they're not going to be high volume. And so I think they are going to be snatched up by inside baseball people. I think they're going to be snatched up by hardcore NSX fans who want something to match their NSX or that has a connection to it.
That's a really good point.
All three people who own an NSX.
Yeah, it's the ultimate daily driver for the NSX owner.
It's what you buy the spouse. It's the family vehicle. And so, yeah, I mean, they're not putting too much into it. Like you know, it's going to be a limited edition. And like I said, 20 years from now, it's going to be the coolest car that people are trying to buy. And it'll probably be affordable too. Modern classic very soon.
Yeah. And then 10 years after that, it'll be like triple what it's worth on Bring a Trailer.
yeah
exactly.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what you could compare it to in terms of so the Olds Achieva SCX,
yeah,
basically any weird super high-end front-wheel drive early 90s GM, that's the same spot this thing is going to occupy in 20
years. And I love it because back in those days when they were selling that Achieva, I wasn't as aware of what was going on, but I'm like, I can see this now before it even comes out. Like, this is what you're going to be in 20 years. And
yeah, you're going to be this like super cool thing. Like, there's going to be a time when that's like a $2,500 Craigslist car.
And I really want everyone who buys them to treat them well, because I will be coming for yours in 20 years. You know, do your oil changes, park it in the garage.
You know, I'll be the third owner that takes kind of good care of it, but I still use it as a winter car.
Well, then I'm not going to buy yours. So, all right. We'd love to hear what everyone out there thinks about the New York Auto Show. By the time you hear this, everything will have debuted. So you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at MotorOneCom, where our discussions of these cars will continue. And of course, on our website, MotorOne.com, you can find all of us in the comments where we'll be talking about the New York debuts. Coming up, we're going to find out what we've all been driving this week. Before the break, though, a reminder that if you're listening to this online, you can also get our show on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So why not hit the subscribe button now so you never miss a show? During this part of the show, we talk about what cars we're driving this week. And today we're going to start with you, Jeff. What are you driving this week?
I am driving the 2019 Mazda CX-5 with the 2.5 turbo engine.
Ah, very nice. So yeah, this is the new, more powerful engine they've released on the CX-5. How is it?
I love it. I mean, the CX-5 in general has always been the sort of anti-crossover in that segment, right? If you wanted something that was fun to drive or more fun to drive, you'd get that. This engine is great. So I had the Mazda 6 turbo, I don't know, a few months ago. And as good as the Mazda 6 was pre-turbo engine, it is just so much better. And the same thing for the CX-5. It's just such a better crossover. It drives so well. And this one is all-wheel drive, which is just, you know, you need that, I think, for this engine.
They punch so far above their weight. If I were advising somebody shopping for a luxury compact crossover, I would say look at the Mazda CX-5. Look at a loaded Mazda CX-5 next to a Range Rover Evoque. I would say their only negative is their size. Like, among compact crossovers, they are tight on the dimensions.
Yeah, it is crazy that you bring up, you know, the interior, how nice it is and just how well finished it is. And you're like, okay, this is luxury car, you know, quality. This thing fully loaded is only 39 grand. And we just had the RAV4 Adventure a few weeks ago, and that was over 40, and it was not nearly as nice as this. So
yeah, then price out a similarly equipped Land Rover, BMW, Mercedes, whatever luxury compact crossover, and you're talking 50 plus, even 60. You know, look, Mazda doesn't sell anything in high volume. That's kind of their thing. But I feel like this deserves to be a really popular, well-selling vehicle. More people should be buying it.
Mazda, I've called Mazda the Japanese BMW for a few years now, because Mazda's kind of making the kind of cars that BMW used to make. They're like BMW in terms of they're this weird small volume manufacturer on the wrong side of the country where they're building cars. Really nice interiors, really good value for the money, just really well-built cars that are kind of fun. And it's like if you see someone else driving a Mazda, full disclosure, my girlfriend and I are both Mazda owners. It's kind of like you're in on the secret. Like you see someone else driving one, you're like, they get it too. Years ago, I was asked to write for one of those like clickbaity slideshow websites where like every slideshow, like every time you clicked and they got a slide, your computer got a different virus.
Yep.
It was like a finance site and they wanted me to write an article about the best luxury cars you can buy for under 35 grand. And I'm like, that's terrible financial advice.
Yeah, that's.
I did like 14 awful penalty box base model luxury cars. And then my last one was the Mazda 6, just the Mazda 6 Grand Touring. And I said, for thousands less, you can live rich instead of looking rich.
Yeah, that's a great point. I feel like the BMW eras that I've loved most is when BMW bakes that driving fun into every trim.
Yeah.
Like it's just,
yeah, I'm sorry.
It's just in the DNA. And that's what Mazdas are like. Any trim level, any vehicle of a Mazda is just, it's that driving fun is baked into it. And you get it no matter what you pay.
I bought a Mazda 2 in 2011. And I think out the door, that was like a $17,000 car, dirt cheap car. And my buddy's big into Mini Coopers. He's owned Mini Coopers since they were new. And he kept calling my car a premium small car because he was so impressed with the interior in my $17,000 car.
Yeah, that Mazda 2.
Of course, it's very plasticky.
So fun to drive.
You know what killed that car in reviews, the Mazda 2? It had a tilt and telus. It had a really adjustable steering column. Like you could adjust it to fit anybody. And a lot of bigger guys, a lot of taller guys that drove those cars, I don't think they expected a car in that price range to have that feature. So they would complain about not being able to fit in it and like their knee bashing into the console and stuff. The adjustment was there. You just didn't realize a car that cheap had that much adjustment in the interior.
Yeah, that'd be fine. I wouldn't put it past an auto journalist not to realize that.
Again, we only spend 2 or 3 weeks with a car.
Yeah,
how do
exactly.
we know?
All right. Well, Cam, let's switch to you. What are you driving this week?
So the weather has turned here. It's gotten a lot better. And I've actually been driving my 1996 Ford Mustang SVT Mystic Cobra around. It's actually going into the museum. I'm the event coordinator for the Crawford Auto and Aviation Museum up in Cleveland. We're doing an exhibit of 80s and 90s cars called Radwood. And my car is going in that exhibit as we're changing some of the cars out. And I've been getting it ready and driving it around and really enjoying. And
wow.
I love this car.
That sounds rare. How many of those are out there? The Mystic.
They made 2,000 Mystic Cobras. The paint is very expensive. So a lot of them, basically, if you got in an accident with the car that was more substantial than having to repaint 2 or 3 panels, you effectively totaled the car. Estimates put it at about 1,600 of them surviving. Mine is extra rare because it's a Canadian export model that came over the border in 2000.
So it's got all the kilometers and instead of miles per hour.
I got pulled over once and the cop was like, this thing goes to 240. I'm like, kilometers, officer.
And what is it about the paint? Is it because I vaguely remember the pictures. Is it like a color changing paint or?
Yeah. So it shifts. The main colors that you see are purple and green. Around dusk, you'll get a beautiful, like a harvest gold and a deep chocolate brown. Occasionally, you'll see like a hint of blue. There's no actual pigment in the paint. So there is a black base coat. There is a layer of microscopic prisms over top of that. And then your clear coat.
That sounds like the coolest thing ever said, that sentence.
It's really cool. So when I was about 7 or 8 years old and that car came out, that was like my dream car because I loved Mustangs already. I was like, my first memory is going to a car show. I've literally been a lifelong car guy. And when I heard, you know, that had the new dual overhead cam aluminum and, you know, V8 engine, and it had this color shifting paint, I thought it was like the space shuttle. Fast forward to when I'm 12, a few streets over, I would occasionally see one parked outside a guy's house, like when he'd be washing it or something. I'm like, oh, that's, you know, I'd like annoy my parents. That's a Mystic Cobra. And that was the only one I ever saw. Years later, when I was 21, I ended up seeing it at a dealership owned by a friend of the family. Long story short, I bought it, went through the paperwork, found out it was that guy's car that he sold. So my Mystic Cobra, as far as...
Has it only had two owners then?
No, it's had a few. It's had, I think, three...
That's crazy that it stayed in the area, though, or came back to the area.
I think it came to... Spent some time in Canada, came to New York 4 years later. So I think that was the second owner was in New York. And then this guy had it in right up the street from my parents. And then I bought it. And now that I have one, I keep running into other people that have them. All these cars have ended up in Ohio. So I know of maybe four or five of them locally. And right before we recorded, I just found out that my dad is so enamored with mine that he sent a guy an offer on one that's selling one. So we might have two Mystics in the family.
So Ohio is going to have the largest collection of Mystic Cobras in the world. I mean, the number of reasons why Ohio is the greatest place on earth is already abundant, but to add that to it.
I will challenge anyone that we have the best car culture anywhere in the country. We're better than Detroit. We're better than Los Angeles. We're better than everybody
else. I mean,
that
is easy to say when none of those people are here to defend those cities, but
I'll say it to their, I've said it to their faces before. I mean, in California, you can't do anything with your cars. It's so expensive to own cars and do anything.
What do you think, Jeff, though? Miami, is Miami's car culture better than Ohio's?
I will not defend Miami's car culture. It's all a bunch of old dudes with Ferraris and Lamborghinis. Right.
You don't want to defend really a tan old people who own 15-year-old supercars?
No.
It's kind of funny. Like when you talk to people on the West Coast and you talk to they get project cars from like mega rare project cars from different place. And like if they had to do any kind of rust repair and you dig a little deeper, they're like, oh yeah, you know, some Goodyear engineer in Ohio had bought this car new, or, you know, some guy owned this. Cause we had a lot of industry up in the area. So there was money in the area up to a certain point. And I think that drove a lot of it.
Well, I think it's similar to Detroit, at least when you talk about like Cleveland and Ohio, where there was a lot of industry back in the day. And a lot of that industry was building cars. And the people in those industries, the assembly workers, were car people themselves. So yeah, a lot of money went into Mustangs back in the day.
Yeah, like I've seen more rare Porsches, like mega rare Porsches, like race cars, in Ohio than any, like in my area of Ohio, in Northeast Ohio than anywhere else. More right-hand drive, weird Japanese stuff than anywhere else.
So in the last podcast, I told, I let everyone know that I had gotten the Audi Q8, but I'd only had it for a day at that point. So I've had it all week, and I should talk about that in this segment, but I don't want to. It's a Q8. It's, you know, it's another Audi vehicle. It's not that interesting. However, I'm going to hijack what I should be talking about during this segment and talk about something else that has been occupying my frontal lobe all day, which is this news that we wrote about today about the company Specialty Vehicle Engineering releasing a revival of the GMC Cyclone using the Canyon, the modern Canyon, as the base. I'm a huge Cyclone / Typhoon fan. I've never driven either. And people tell me that I wouldn't like them if I drove them now because they do drive like old vehicles, but I loved them back in the day and I hope to own one eventually. But I also love revivals. I love when modern cars, are made, they make a vintage version that celebrates one of these original great cars. So Specialty Vehicle Engineering, they released a couple pictures. It's, you know, an all black two-door Cyclone. It does have a slight extended cab, unlike the original Cyclone. The engine they're using is not, you know, like the original Cyclones, which was a twin turbo V6. This is a supercharged version of the Cyclone. Of the Canyon's 3.6 liter V6. It is producing 455 horsepower, though, which is considerably more than the original Cyclone's 280. And they can do this kind of package on any Canyon that you bring them. So that's kind of interesting, too. But it's all black. It's lowered. It's got kind of Cyclone-ish wheels. They're not the same, but it's got the same Cyclone script on the side. It's pushing all of my nostalgia buttons. I just want one, or at least want to try driving one. So I'm not driving it this week. This is completely the wrong segment to bring it up, but it is occupying my mind.
So you like that better than the AEV Bison?
Yes, I do. I do like it more than the Bison. The Bison is off-road, but I've driven a Raptor. I don't want an off-road vehicle that can crawl at 5 miles an hour. I want an off-road vehicle that can go 80 miles an hour and jump. So the Bison can't go 80 miles an hour and jump like a Raptor. So to me, the Raptor is better.
The coolest thing about the Bison is the name.
Yeah.
Only reason I wanted to bring it up was just so I could say Bison.
This Cyclone, though, like I said, it's just close enough in looks to the original Cyclone that it pushes my button. I wish they would have gone even further to try and make it look even more, but I'll take what I can get.
Well, Cynical Jeff is back, and I don't know.
Did he ever leave?
That company, so we've gotten a lot of press releases from them, and we've written a lot of stuff about them, and pretty much every project that they send us is some old name that has some sort of, you know, heritage slapped on top of a modern car with very little updating, right? So they have a Yanko Corvette, which is a Corvette with a supercharger, and that's about it. And this is at least a little cooler. It's got some new wheels and some other stuff, but it's like, I don't know.
I agree. They make a Yanko Corvette and a Camaro, and I completely agree about that, that they're just kind of trading on the name. And they go a little farther with the Cyclone. All your points, I don't think you're being cynical. I think you're speaking the truth. For me, they hit the target with the Cyclone. I don't care about Yankos, but you know, who knows? If I was a collector of Yanko Camaros, I'd be like, oh, that's the coolest thing ever. I'm just a huge Cyclone fan.
Yeah. Well, so am I. And it's weird though that GMC doesn't have the trademark to Cyclone still, or can they just use it however?
I think this company might be small enough that they think they could just get away with it. Like, I don't know. I've already emailed somebody at GMC chastising them that they didn't create a Cyclone revival from the factory before this company. And I told them there's still time with the Typhoon. We could make a 450 horsepower GMC Terrain and slap a Typhoon badge on it, make it all black.
Is GMC getting a version of the new Blazer?
I don't think so. I haven't heard anything about that.
Because if they did, that would be awesome. That's Typhoon.
They shouldn't even.
I thought I was okay with the Blazer when it came out. Again, like, not a big time crossover guy. When I actually saw one at the auto show in person, I'm like, this is kind of a hot looking.
The Blazer is very striking, and I think they should do exactly what you said. They shouldn't even bring the Blazer over to GMC as like anything other than a Typhoon. It should just be a 450 horsepower. Yeah. Now I'm going to be thinking about that all day.
We should write about it.
We should, yeah. Op-ed time.
We should have like a rendering guy do a render for us, and then we'll get.
Oh my god, you're right. We're totally gonna do that. Yeah. I'm gonna go tell our renderist to get to work on that now. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow Jeff on Twitter at not a boat captain. By the way, I love these Twitter names that you guys have. So that was not a boat captain for Jeff, and you could follow Cam at low class yuppie on Twitter. And as for me, I'm boring. You can follow me at John_M_Neff. Clearly I have some work to do in the Twitter brandy department. Thank you, Jeff and Cam, for joining me on the show.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And thank all of you out there for listening, and we'll see you next week.